This meeting is now being recorded.
Thanks, everyone, and welcome to the 19th plenary call of the City Review Team. Is there anyone that is on the phone but not in the Adobe Connect?
Jamie Evelyn.
And are there any? Thanks, Jamie. And are there any updates to anyone's statements of interest? All right. Jordan said he may try to connect in via his airplane Wi-Fi, but we won't hold our breath on that. Let's roll right into some summaries and discussion. And then on to some discussion with Elisa about the Global Restaurant Survey. And then the other business. So why don't we go ahead and jump to the duplicate names summary presentation. Who was going to be doing that?
Jordan was.
Oh, Jordan was. Okay.
Yeah, he asked if you could lead the conversation if he's not able to make it.
Oh, for this one as well. Okay, all right. I was going to do the trademark one. Let me, okay.
So, trademark. we do have a recap of points that Jordan prepared for the trademark.
I do have them.
We do have them on the screen here.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Stan did some excellent analysis of the data that we were given by the analysis group, and Jordan kind of bubbled these up to a couple of bullet points for discussion purposes. And so there's basically 3 points. As with the previous expansion of the GTLD space, some trademark holders engaged in defensive registrations. The sample studied by analysis group, 54% of trademarks registered in .com were registered in one or more of new GTLDs. Most of the trademarks are only registered in a small number of GTLDs, a median of 3, although a smaller number of trademarks are registered in many, sometimes hundreds of GTLDs. So those are sort of the summary points from Stan's analysis that we wanted to put out there. The one thing that isn't captured yet, and I don't think we've identified the best way to capture it, is the costs associated with blocking. But hopefully that will be part of something that surfaces as part of the INTA survey, so that we'll have a better sense of the level of blocking that's going on, because Donuts is one of the biggest purveyors of new GTLDs, and they offer a blocking solution. So those were the findings. Does anybody have any questions about them, or which I'll try to direct at Stan, I think. But if they make sense, then we may direct you back to the text that was written by Stan. So does anybody have any questions or comments about these 3 findings? Carlos, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Jonathan, and I hope you get better soon. Just a comment. Can we include a 4th bullet where we compare with the number of trademarks that jump into the first level? Does it make sense? Because right now it doesn't mention that some trademarks just take the jump and move upwards into the first level. I don't know if that is, but it seems to me that it gives some kind of context. Thank you.
Thanks, Carlos. I think that the issue there, obviously, is that not everyone's motivation for doing that is defensive in nature, but more often proactive. And so this particular thing was about how trademark holders are handling things at the second level domain. So if you can make the case for why that constitutes a defensive registration, then please make it. But I'm not sure that that's in evidence anywhere. Thanks, Carlos. Laureen, go ahead.
Thanks. I was wondering, Stan, or anyone, I understand that these are numbers about the numbers of perhaps defensive domains and the comparison between folks who have a domain registered in .com and the new gTLDs. But I was wondering, have we or should we perform any analysis about whether the domains that exist in both .com and the new gTLDs, whether the ones in new gTLDs are actually are active and being used? And I think this goes back to the whole, you know, parked issue that was raised during our last call. So let me put it more simply. For all these new gTLDs that are being, for all the domains that are being registered in new gTLDs, are they actually being used, or are they just being bought?
So this is Jamie. I'm on the phone. If I could come in at some point, that would be great.
Okay, Jamie, go ahead.
So I think we've had some discussion about this before, my understanding is it's not always clear that multiple registrations are necessarily purely defensive in nature. They can also be for traffic aggregation, redirection, where they think that search may point people in a different place. I was wondering if there will be discussion about the difficulty that exists in identifying whether or not something is in fact defensive. For example, a second level in a new G that points back to a brand's .com address is not necessarily defensive at all. It's part of it could be part of a broader marketing and traffic strategy. Thanks.
Jonathan, you may be on mute. Jonathan? Okay. Why don't we go to Calvin while Jonathan picks up his phone. Thank you. Calvin?
Yes, Calvin here. I was just wondering if any work has been done on assigning a dollar value to these registrations. Although Jamie's question kind of makes it less important, I was wondering if there's anything like that at all.
Stan, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I actually have a few things to say. I think at this, it's a perfectly reasonable question. I don't think anybody at this point has data on that, and it would be useful to get it. Actually, let me respond to a couple of things that have already been said just very quickly. This document is somewhat different, slightly different from the document that was circulated about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I'll just quickly tick off the things that have been done in response to comments that were made. One is that Megan pointed out that not all duplicate registrations are defensive, as the point that Jamie just made. And so there is a brief discussion of that. Second, Aliza pointed me to a question in the Nielsen survey that talks about or gives reasons some of the registrants gave for duplicate registrations. And so there's a brief discussion of that. David pointed out that notwithstanding the availability of what I might think of as quasi-legal ways of preventing someone else from using your trademark, he points out that some of his clients nonetheless engage in duplicate registration because that's cheaper than invoking the legal or the quasi-legal process. Fourth, this reflects Jonathan's comment on the earlier call about blocking. So there are a couple of examples of registries that offer a blocking service, which is apparently less expensive than duplicate registrations. I don't think we know how costly those are, but there's a discussion of that in the draft. And finally, Jordan made the point that that probably the median is a better measure of the extent of duplicate registrations because of the skewness, the one guy who registered 400, apparently registered in 400 domains. So this is a living document, and any comments that people send me, I actually prefer getting them in writing because it's clear to me what the questioner wants to put in. But I've been trying to respond as people give me comments, and as you can see, there are at least these five changes since the earlier draft. That's it.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks a lot for the updates that you've made to the document. This is always going to have been a problematic statistic when we were in the planning phases for the CCT trying to come up with measures of defensive registrations. We didn't come up with any, really. And so these are just proxies for that hopefully give, over a series of different statistics maybe begin, and the survey begin to give some indication of the level of defensive registrations. And hopefully we'll get a better understanding of that, including the use of blocking, from the INTA trademark holder survey. We'll get a better understanding of where the trademark strategies have morphed, because the old strategy of that was used primarily by those in the financial industry, I think, like PayPal, et cetera, just sort of registering everything everywhere, just isn't feasible in the, under the new GTLD program. And so everybody's changing their strategy, and hopefully we'll learn more about that from the INTA survey. Stan, I had it in my head that we actually had some indications of what the costs were for blocking. Did the stuff that we find not end up being rigorous enough to cite?
You had to remind me where that is. I don't really know. What I did after you mentioned this on the last call is I went to the websites of a couple of registries, the one you recommended and another one. I don't believe any of them provide price information, for example, but if you have more data, I'd be happy to include it.
Okay, Stan, I'll get back with you. It wasn't data provided by them. It came in directly and was in some analysis argument articles, but I'll try to track those down again.
No, that's great. Thank you.
Calvin, thank you, Stan. Thanks for your work on this. Calvin, is that an old hand?
Yeah, thanks. Answers my question. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay.
Jonathan, have we lost you? Or are you on?
Sorry, yes, I was muted. Thanks. Okay. Let's move to the duplicate name summary. Sorry. Hopefully I didn't say anything of any import while I was muted.
We will never know.
That's right. I certainly won't. A little under the weather. Okay. So this was the question that we talked a little bit on the last call, and Jordan likes to use my example from the Big Shots Photography that I bought, and frankly couldn't explain why I did it. But the sub question is: you register on Sputnik new GTLDs even when an equivalent SLD is available in .com. So that equivalent means, in the case of Big Shots Photography, BigShots.photography I purchased even though BigShotsPhotography.com was available. So that's sort of the equivalent that we're looking at. And in 18% of the registrations in new GTLDs, the second level was available. So that's fairly small. That means that somebody's actually bought good.something else when good.com was available. So that's a fairly small. And of the TLDs with at least 1,000 registrations, 32 had less than 1% of the registrations available in the form of a second-level domain. So for the most part, com was taken in these registrations. IDNs tend to have more equivalent second-level domains in com. those are the three that are most popular. And 30% of the second-level domains registered in GTLDs were available in .com. In 92% of the registrations, the concatenated TLD was available. So, in other words, if you've got good.example, goodexample.com was available. And so, I think he's made some conjecture here in causes that in some cases users prefer to register the new GTLD even when the second level is available in .com. The vast majority of the new GTLD registrations could have been registered in .com instead of in the form of sldtld.com. In general, it appears the new GTLD registrants prefer the shorter form over the longer form. For many GTLDs, this is true despite the fact that the retail price for the GTLD is typically higher than for .com. Overall registrations at the second level in new GTLDs tend toward common terms already registered in .com. Are there any questions about these findings or comments? If I may be so bold, I think this is one of the most interesting findings that we have because it does suggest that there's, and coupled with the registrant survey questions around a desire to have a keyword-based taxonomy for the Internet, sort of, I think these two go in hand-in-hand, and I think that's interesting. Other folks with comments, questions about this? Because the next step will be Jordan turning this into a paper, much like the ones that Stan has circulated. So this is the time to get at the main points if you see a problem with them or a problem with the conclusions, because the next thing you'll be looking at is a draft. Okay. If there's no further questions, then we'll the next stage for this will be prose in conjunction with information about the registrant survey, and we'll move on to registry policies.
Jonathan, sorry to jump in. Could we give a deadline for any comments on the papers so everyone is clear on when they should get their input?
Sure. Let's say that any comments on these worksheets need to be done within by the time of the end of next week. I mean, we really want to let things get to draft form if people don't have objections. So try to get your comments even sooner if you can. Okay. Thanks, Alice.
Thank you.
You want to move to the registry policies?
Sure. I'm not sure Dehan was on the call, though.
Okay. Let's I don't see him. Dehan, are you on the call? All right, well, let's skip over this in case he gets on the call, and we'll switch over to Laureen to discuss consumer trust.
Thanks, Jonathan. So what I've done in this in this discussion paper is I've looked at both the Nielsen Consumer Survey, the Nielsen Registrant Survey, and also an NCC paper on consumer trust, and tried to pluck out the portions of those surveys, at least the Nielsen studies, that deal with consumer trust, because they deal with a lot of other issues as well. And I'll go through this, but at a high level, the comparison between the level of trust for new GTLDs and legacy GTLDs is that consumers tend to trust legacy GTLDs approximately twice as much as they do for new GTLDs. And then certain factors come into play about why consumers visit GTLDs, what is important in terms of trust. We have some findings regarding consumers' behavior, and also interesting findings regarding expectations for restrictions. So with that as a high level, I'll move through the findings. What we find from these surveys is that consumers visit top-level domains in general based on the relevance of information they're trying to find. And also they tend to visit domains that they're more familiar with. They don't visit new GTLDs as much as legacy GTLDs. In 2015, well, I'll do 2016 because it's more recent, but there was a comparison of 81% for legacy GTLDs in terms of high visitation rates versus 12% of new GTLDs having high visitation rates. The second wave of the Nielsen survey added some more new GTLDs to their questions, and that bumped up the visitation rate slightly to 15%. The NCC study, which I'll note does seem in part to have a focus on propounding the benefits of trusted brands, but that study indicated some discomfort with visiting websites ending in new domains. About half the survey respondents reported feeling very comfortable, which of course means that almost half didn't feel comfortable. On the question of whether consumers trust new GTLDs as much as legacy GTLDs, again, we have this finding that for new GTLDs, at least in 2016, 45% found new GTLDs very or somewhat trustworthy, and that's compared to 91% finding legacy GTLDs very or somewhat trustworthy. And it ticked up a little bit in 2016 compared to 2015. When the question was more specific to certain specified new GTLDs, the Nielsen survey had a collection of new GTLDs. The numbers increased. 60% in 2016 found the specified new GTLDs as trustworthy. And those GTLDs were .news, .photography, .email, .realtor. Those were found trustworthy. .news was the most trustworthy. But I believe there was a question as to whether all these GTLDs were in fact even delegated, which means that the respondents may have a comfort level with certain words that are familiar, but that it doesn't actually mean they visited the site and found that to be trustworthy. It seems that the very familiarity with the word may lead to some perception of trustworthiness. For registrants, their perception of legacy GTLDs as trustworthy actually went down in 2016 from 83% to 79%. And they associate the term trustworthy with legacy GTLDs more than new GTLDs. That's for registrants. Question three is, and maybe we can, do people have independent scrolling capability here? So folks scroll down to question three. You'll see that this gets at a behavior issue, which is very important because it gives us an objective measure of an action that's associated with trustworthiness. So the question asked was whether consumers feel comfortable providing sensitive information, i.e. health or financial information, to new GTLDs compared to legacy GTLDs. And then we asked that for several different measures. And generally speaking, again, we see that consumers rated new GTLDs as about half the amount of trustworthiness or comfort level, I'll say, because that's the precise wording. They were only half as comfortable providing sensitive information. So if we're talking about financial information, for example, in 3D, for dot-coms, consumers felt 62% of consumers felt somewhat comfortable, but for new GTLDs, only 36% did. For question four, we have a question about trust, offering whether consumers trust new GTLDs to take precautions regarding who gets a new domain name, give consumers what they think they're getting, screen individuals who register for certain domain names. And those findings are a little bit more optimistic. Overall, the consumers trust the domain industry to perform those functions. And another interesting finding is that 55% expect websites registered under domains to have a very clear relationship to the GTLD to which it's registered. So, for example, and we've talked about this in calls before, our .photography domain, consumers would expect that if they're visiting a domain with .photography, that it actually has something to do with photography. The questions under question five deal with another important topic, and that's an expectation about restrictions and whether that contributes to consumer trust, restrictions on who can purchase domain names. So when we ask, do the restrictions on who can purchase domain names contribute to consumer trust, in 2016, the answer was yes, 70% for all GTLDs, and the registrant survey also supported that finding. And regarding new GTLDs specifically, in 2016, 73% expected restrictions on new GTLDs, and registrants also favored strict or some purchase restrictions. Going a little more quickly, for question six, consumers do expect restrictions to be enforced, and they trust that restrictions will be enforced. Question seven for the consumer survey was a text box where we specifically asked, what makes domain extensions trustworthy? And the, some common answers were reputation and familiarity. The NCC group also asked related questions to this. What factors increase confidence in new domains? And a lot of these had to do with communications about what steps the domain is taking to secure your personal information on the website, some sort of evidence of a standard of security, and there were also specific questions about verified brands, i.e. brands that somehow are go through a procedure or screening process. When we ask the question in the converse, what are the reasons for avoiding unfamiliar domain extensions? Again, this lack of familiarity and a concern about security ranks high. And a related NCC finding showed that there's an increase in 2015 to 2016 regarding concerns of stolen financial information and personal information, so a fear of stolen credentials or identity theft. So when we look at the big picture here, to summarize, trust really seems tied to familiarity with the GTLD and the reputation of the GTLD and how often the consumer uses that GTLD. That those seem like two issues that really are key to trustworthiness of the GTLD, whether it's a new GTLD or a legacy GTLD. And familiarity with the GTLD depends upon visitation, and the questions in the surveys seem to point to relevance to the information sought is a really high factor for visitation. And then finally, there's a recognition that both consumers and registrants expect that there are going to be some type of restrictions in the sale of GTLDs, and this expectation increased in 2016 for both legacy and new GTLDs. So those are a summary of the trust findings that are evident in the consumer survey and the registrant survey and also this NCC survey on consumer trust. And I'm happy to take questions.
Lorene, this is Jonathan. I guess my first question is, do you feel like this starts to feed into a narrative that's less driven by the questions of the survey and more some overall conclusions that you feel like you can begin to state from the survey results?
I think the narrative would be that that people are less familiar with new GTLDs and therefore inclined to trust them less, at least at this point. But this is all still very new. In a sense, this is to keep using that photography image. This is a snapshot in a sense, I think the thing. You know, we're going to have a much clearer image over time. But the narrative, I think, would be that that consumers as a whole are less familiar with new GTLDs, therefore visit them less and trust them less. However, factors that can increase trust relate to the relevance of the domain for the information they're seeking. If they're seeking very specific information and that's in a new GTLD, they would be apt to visit that new GTLD more and, assuming they had a good experience, likely trust that new GTLD more. And then the other key finding, I think, goes to this expectation of restrictions that not just anybody's going to be able to buy a new GTLD, and that that combined with a heightened anxiety about threats on the internet dealing with stolen credentials or impermissible use of folks' sensitive information feeds into this expectation for restrictions. That would be the narrative I see emerging at this point.
Thanks, Lorene. David's got his hand up.
David. David, we can't hear you.
Lorene, do you want to tackle Carlton's question in the meantime while David figures out his AV?
Yeah, I'm just reading it. Carlton has asked, for those on the phone, in context of information-seeking behaviors, do you think the way consumers navigate to the GTLD would be important? It's an interesting question, and I'd have to give it more thought. I think the way people navigate to a GTLD may actually mask whether they know where they're navigating to. So if they're just typing in a search term, and it's in Google, perhaps, or any other search engine, and then they're clicking on a result that seems relevant, they may not even be focused on whether it's a new GTLD or a legacy GTLD. They just may want the information sought. And, in that regard, I don't know that it would make a difference whether it's a legacy GTLD or a new GTLD to the person trying to find the information. The most important thing would be the relevance of the information. So I think in that way it could be important. But the other issue would be I think some of the findings point to different comfort levels in how people are navigating to new GTLDs and comfort levels perhaps with search engines, but not with social media, for example, seeing one is more or less trustworthy. So I'd have to think it through more, but those are sort of my preliminary thoughts.
Jonathan, can I get in the queue? This is Jamie.
We're waiting on David to get audio back again, so you're at the front of the queue, Jamie.
So this is really about both sections or both subgroups, and that is, as we've discussed before, we're obviously early in the life cycle of new GTLDs, and there's a lot of data that's going to be sort of tentative or inconclusive or not there yet. And so I was wondering on your question, Jonathan, about a narrative, whether in as part of the overall report we wouldn't sort of recommend questions and areas of to pursue for the next one based on what we've found thus far. So if there's as Lorene was saying that there's sort of mixed results on trust, do those change? Do people trust it more with more familiarity, or do they continue to not trust new GTLDs? Similarly with the competition thing, what questions could we ask or suggest that would look at the market in the way we tried to, but weren't able to because it just wasn't data.
All
Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie. I think that's a good point. Oh, go ahead, Louis.
Yeah, I think we were going to say the same thing.
I defer to you to say it.
Okay. I think it's a good point, Jamie, that part of our task here.
Jamie, you've had your George Costanza moment. But I think it's actually a good general point in that throughout the paper, as we see areas where data deficiencies or better phrased questions or, you know, things like that would be helpful, we should make sure that we're mentioning them and as part of our prescription for the next CCT review. So there's time, and there's also sort of what we've learned about some of these topics as we've delved into them that'll help dictate the type of study that future teams do. David is apparently back with us and has his hand up, so I'm going to hand the microphone to him.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, thank goodness for that. Sorry about that before. No idea what's going on. I've got a headpiece and everything, so I wasn't using the audio of the computer. But there we go. I could hear everybody perfectly, and then suddenly when it was my time to speak, no one could hear me. Just a couple of comments on number three, Laureen, where we'd got whether consumers feel somewhat comfortable. I suppose really my takeaway from that when I looked at this was, you know, we're looking at sort of 34% to 48% for the new GTLDs feeling somewhat comfortable, which is, half to two-thirds of consumers are not comfortable providing that information to new GTLDs. That seems to be quite a pertinent thing on comfortable. It just seemed to me that somewhat comfortable sort of seemed to fudge over a little bit what I would see as a general uncomfortableness in providing anything. So I don't know whether that was a takeaway which you also felt was there or not, or to discuss. Then I got another point as well, but happy to talk that one through.
Yeah, I mean, when you flip these numbers for the new GTLDs around, you do see that a majority, in all cases, and in some cases more, you know, almost two thirds don't feel comfortable. That's what the numbers tell us.
Hmm. Okay. That's certainly a takeaway. And I think, and then on 4A, when I was looking there, the 71%, 71% believe consumers get what they think they're getting. And again, I think the very pertinent thing there is the question B, is that true?
Right.
Because that's a very high, you know, there's a certain amount of gullibility in there, perhaps. If you go to a website and you 71% believe that they think they're getting what they see there, is high, and a very high element of trust generally. Certainly when I go to a website, I don't believe it unless I know the domain name. So I think that's something which is key for that, is whether it's true or not. Now, I don't know how we get at that data, because that's something which would then become very pertinent. So, again, that was just throwing that out. And then on 4C, I think it was, yes, where we got 55. This is back to my point of heart at the beginning a little bit. 55% expect the websites reflect a very clear relationship to the TLD, which we've already discussed, the dot photography or the dot film. So I suppose the question is that expectation borne out? So, of course, there's many TLDs out there with second-level registrations without any control whatsoever. So is that level borne out or not? And how do we get data on that? Because that, again, seems to be quite key to me or pertinent. That was my thoughts.
And I think that's, as Jonathan observed, that may be a place where we identify that as an area for further study in the future, and thought given as to how you would collect that data, whether it would involve sampling certain websites and having folks review that under certain criteria. It would require some good thinking to figure out how you would get at that data regarding whether these expectations being met.
Thanks, Dave. Laureen, do you want to address Jordan's text in the chat?
Yeah, I'm. yes, Jordan. Jordan is speculating that a lot of the survey responses are speculative, since it's people saying, I've never heard of that, and I wouldn't trust it that much. And he's contrasting an inquiry that would have been based on actual consumer behavior when encountering these domains. So the truth is, we don't know. These surveys, you know, ask people questions and then trust that people are going to be giving, you know, thoughtful, accurate responses to the best of their ability. But whether that actually happens, we don't know. And I think Jordan is thinking about some sort of different study that would put people actually face to face with perhaps different websites and seeing what they do. That's an interesting idea.
Very intimidating at the moment, but it is interesting. And I think that Jordan's supposition is somewhat confirmed by the notion that in the awareness portions of all these surveys, there's a higher awareness of words that are easier to understand and things like that, too. So I mean, it is all in a way kind of hypothetical, but gets at behavior for consumers that their familiarity with the term, their familiarity with the URL would lead to an increased trust. And I think we can draw that kind of conclusion as opposed to necessarily drawing one that there isn't trust.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the last part of your conclusion. The familiarity leads to trust, I understood, but what was the last part?
So the last part is that a lot of what we can glean from this is that familiarity breeds trust, whether it's with the term in use or an understanding of it. And so that's the more interesting conclusion in some respects than the actual statistical measures of trust that we got out of this survey. It's more about understanding consumer behavior as opposed to the numbers of in trust itself.
Yeah, I think that's a fair conclusion.
Any other questions for Laureen? Okay, we got some answers to questions that we had posed to the Nielsen group, so I wanted to hand it over to Aliza to share those answers with us.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks. I'll just go through this at a high level. I don't want to read the paper for you. But basically, these were answers to questions that you all had posed in Vienna after Dave Dickinson's presentation to you. So the first block was an additional note on the methodology and how people are selected for panels. Nielsen uses consumer research panels where they contact people for a variety of purposes, and if you meet the qualifications for a particular survey, that's how you end up on within a sample of a given survey. So they provide some details there. The next question had to do with who tends to register a domain under new GTLD. So we have a couple of characteristics here that Dave was able to tease out from the demographics and statistics we had available. They tend to be younger, tend to be registered for personal uses, and in terms of business uses, tends to come for larger companies. I apologize, I'm juggling my daughter on my own this morning, so you might hear her opinion as well.
Okay.
So we also have some information on motivations and behaviors of the GTL program. So a little bit more detail there. And I just made my text really small. There we go. Let's see. So they're more likely to register duplicate domain names, which we just discussed, have more names in total. They looked a little bit into the details of those who were not familiar with any GTLDs and whether they would consider where else they would consider registering, as well as some information on switching behavior, which we talked a little bit about this in detail a bit more with Stan and the competition subteam, because this is a topic of particular interest for them on why new GTLD registrants are registering duplicate domains. This was a bit of a tricky question to break down because the way the question was answered gave registrants the opportunity to say applies to all, applies to some, so you see a lot of doubling up across categories and you see the breakdown in front of you. And then we also got into some questions related to trust. I think we have in here whether those who experience bad behaviors, for example, or abusive behaviors, if there's a correlation between familiarity and experience there and trust. It seems like there doesn't seem to be a strong relationship there. And then finally, a little bit more detail on the restrictions on registration and people's perceptions of how that impacts their levels of trust and use of TLDs, or how they think TLDs should be restricted in terms of registration behaviors. So that's a really high-level overview, but those are the general topics that we discussed, and I'm happy to answer any more questions. Or if you have more requests for Nielsen on CrossTab, we can go back to them on some of these questions if you'd like more detailed answers.
Any questions for Lisa? Okay. So there was some discussion about the surveys generally on the last call, and I guess in particular on the Super Trust call. And I don't know how many of you saw Kevin Murphy's blog on the surveys. And so I touched on this a little bit before, but I mean, one of the things that happened basically is that the fourth survey, the second registrant survey, was kind of an anomaly in terms of its absolute figures. And so it looked like some fairly dramatic changes had taken place when they hadn't really. And so the awareness question in general is part of the biggest problem that we face. And I think that we're at a point that it's too early to really tell. And the variations were within the margin of error for the surveys. And so if we look at the first and second consumer surveys, we see that the numbers on trust are fairly similar. And we also see a correlation between what consumers and registrants thought on trust. And so it's kind of reasonable to assume that there hasn't been much movement in consumer trust associated with that fourth survey, and that the absolute values themselves are more of an anomaly. But it does show that there's been some interesting relative choices that people make from within the survey, and we discussed a little bit of that, that there's an interest in these restrictions. There's an interest in, I guess some of you questioned, I know Calvin asked about the notion of a taxonomy, and I guess I didn't mean a hierarchical taxonomy in my blog post, but instead was talking about sort of a keyword-based taxonomy of the web, and that there seems the survey seems to reveal that there's an interest in these words having meaning when you get to them, and they're not entirely generic. And so those are some of the conclusions that we're able to get from the surveys. And I think that it's very easy to see that there hasn't been a dramatic ding in trust over the course of the 1 year that we've been delegating into the root. But it's difficult, and the data doesn't give us enough to say that there's been an increase in trust either from the consumer data. So in some ways, these surveys are more interesting when looked at against themselves as opposed to compared over time, which was our original intention. So that's sort of the conversations that I had with Nielsen about the surveys, and some of that is captured in Kevin Murphy's blog. Some of it isn't. I think he got confused along the way. But that's the I think the overall narrative on this notion of awareness and trust is that what we're seeing is, you know, how people think they feel as opposed to how they really feel, which gets to Jordan's point as well. Calvin, go ahead.
Okay, so it almost seems to me, you know, as long as trust isn't going down and you introduce more competition or more choice, that it's on a winning streak there.
Calvin, thanks. I think that's a good observation. I mean, obviously, remember we've in the and Laureen may speak to this as well, in the narrative around consumer trust, we've started to make a distinction between trust and trustworthiness. And so some of the issues that will hopefully be revealed as part of the DNS abuse survey may suggest a trustworthiness problem in some of these domains that needs to be addressed, which just hasn't hit people yet and caused a decrease in trust. But I think generally what you're saying is true, as we are looking at a balance of interests here, and all things being equal, I think that giving people the freedom to have new strings is the objective of the DTLD program. We just need to make sure that we're looking at some of the downside consequences for trademark holders, as well as looking more carefully at some of the DNS abuse, because there has been some more anecdotal data about DNS abuse in the new DTLD. So I don't know how that study will turn out, so I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I think that we need to make sure we don't get ahead of ourselves in our narrative until we've looked at some of the downside consequences of the new GTLP program, and we haven't really looked at those yet.
And Jonathan, I just wanted to jump in. This is Laureen. I agree. Our narrative on consumer trust is distinguishing between the subjective views of whether consumers trust the DNS, trust the legacy and new GTLD, so that we have a point of comparison, and then looking at moving to the objective, is there trustworthiness? So we're hoping to be able to gather some data that compares levels of abuse between legacy GTLDs and new GTLDs, and seeing what that data shows us, and then of course there's information that we have just by way of comparisons. There are different requirements and restrictions in place for new GTLDs that don't exist for the legacy GTLDs, and those in and of themselves are information that we can look at regarding trustworthiness. So there are different factors at play, and it's not just the subjective component, it's this objective component.
That's exactly right. Well stated, Laureen, and I I forgot to mention that we also have an upside objective measure that's related to the pick specs and things like that that might suggest an increase in trustworthiness as a, in addition to the things we're looking at where we're trying to see whether there was a decrease. Any other questions? Okay, folks, this is going to be a short call. We need to really get on top of getting these templates done and circulated within your subteams so that we can do these presentations in the plenary and get buy-in from the team on them so that people can begin to draft actual prose. So I'm going to give some thought to some best practices for how we engage with each other going forward in the near term here. We are short on time, and we need to turn up the heat, and at the same time try not to get testy as a result. So let's make sure that we keep our opinions at bay and focus on provable points and keep our comments constructive. And I'll be trying to write something down and running it by the other team leads to circulate for your approval. But let's all get to work. Use this time to work on the things that you have in front of you, and let's make sure that we're getting these findings done in presentable form in time for the Hyderabad meeting. All right, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jonathan.